From WXXI News, it's Connections Education Friday. I'm Frank Sigelski. This hour of Connections Education Friday, we're going to discuss hot topics in higher education with returning guest and expert, and also Brighton High School graduate Scott Jasek. He is also one of the co-founders and co-editor of InsideHigherEd.com, a leading resource for everything about higher education. He's been on the show before. He is an expert, and we invite your questions, calls, comments, a lot of issues out there. Again, we have a new number to, if you want to call the show. It's 1-844-295-TALK. Talk is the numbers 8255. But without further ado, Scott Jasek, welcome back to Connections Education Friday. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for making yourself available. And, you know, most folks have heard you before, and they know that you're, Rochester, you were raised in Rochester and graduated from Brighton High, attended Cornell. And I should have assumed that you had worked at the Chronicle of Higher Education at some point, but I just noticed that for the first time. But you are one of the co-founders of InsideHigherEd.com, and you've got your finger on the pulse of everything that's going on out there. And some of the things that we're thinking about, talking about sexual assault on campus, the related issue of fraternities, heroin on campus, and should selfies be banned? Of course, the Supreme Court had that big decision in affirmative action. So I'm going to let you just set the stage, maybe big overview, and we'll get into the issues as you see fit.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the sexual assault issue, because that's probably, it's not a new issue, but it's getting more attention than ever before. Obviously, sexual assault has been around for a long time, including on campuses. But what's happened, particularly in the last 2 years, is that more women are speaking out. And so victims are coming forward and saying, this happened to me. The college did not handle my complaint well, and that has captured the attention of people in Congress, and it's captured the attention of the Obama administration. Colleges are being sued, and now the Obama administration is pushing colleges to make sure they handle these complaints in a more responsible way.
So basically, it's an issue of this has always been going on. We don't know, but is it more that, or is there anything about today's society, aside from the fact that it's being reported more, that shows why this is a trend, if that's what we can even conclude?
So, historically, and I think today as well, rape and sexual assault is an underreported crime. So it's very hard to make comparisons. But historically, a lot of women didn't report, or if they reported and weren't taken seriously, didn't speak out. What we're seeing on a lot of campuses is women going public with their complaints and taking colleges to task. Now, there are two tracks here that women can take in terms of a complaint, and they can take both. One is obviously using the local police and filing a charge of rape or sexual assault or whatever. There's also, though, the responsibility of the college to provide an environment free from sexual harassment. And so at the same time, or sometimes only, a woman will file a complaint with the college saying, so-and-so did this, and so you need to take action. One of the big changes is that colleges many times referred these to sort of student judicial boards that may have been created to handle plagiarism cases or academic misconduct, and it may not know how to handle a report of sexual violence. The other reality, and this puts the college judicial systems at more of a disadvantage, is that sexual assault and rape are now investigated by police with physical evidence. These need not be, in many cases, he said, she said, but there's actual evidence. In many cases, that police can collect, but many colleges aren't necessarily as equipped to collect.
Yeah, that's interesting. Would you think that traditionally, just like other groups and organizations, when something like this, you know, is going on and there's almost like a code of silence or this subtle acceptance or, you know, well, there's a huge gray area, it makes it all the more difficult for people to go forward? And would you say that that's been part of the problem traditionally at the university setting?
I mean, historically, many women feel they've been discouraged from pursuing cases. Some of the prominent cases have also involved athletes or people who were in one way or another privileged on campus. And so there's the question that has been raised about whether colleges protect certain people who are accused in ways that really deny rights to women. Now, there are also cases that are all over the place in terms of who did what, whether there's enough evidence, and so forth. But there has been just a steady drumbeat of complaints where women have come forward and described colleges seeming to be unsympathetic, unwilling to pursue charges. And that's what's gotten the Education Department and the Obama administration involved.
Okay, so part of it is actually taking these cases as seriously as they should be taken. But I want to go back to the other piece, because wouldn't you think that the schools, if they announce a prevention is worth a pound of cure type thing, do you not think that education of students, male and female, so that it's understood what the issues even are? I mean, I know in the high schools, they've really gotten progressive in terms of teaching health and education and personal welfare, which includes, you know, basically what are the scenarios? Because there is a gray area, I suppose you could say.
I think many colleges have added significantly to what they're to talking about this issue, say, during freshman orientation, during all sorts of educational programming. There's a lot of educational programming on this on any campus. But here's the tricky thing, is that many of the cases of sexual assault take place in an environment where there's been a lot of consumption of alcohol, and that doesn't necessarily have people remembering what they were taught at freshman orientation.
Yeah.
And there is a culture in some organizations of doing what people want, which isn't necessarily respecting the rights of women. So if just having educational programming were going to solve this problem, I think it might have been solved. There's a lot of educational programming, but as with many things, there is a there has to be enforcement. And I think where the criticism is greatest is of whether there's enough enforcement.
And it sounds very similar or parallel to what we've seen in the, you know, in the armed services, in terms of that whole issue coming to the forefront and being buried in a culture of it's not that big a deal, or you really don't want to, whatever, you don't want to. It would be uncomfortable if this came out in the public. I think we can learn a lot from that. Again, our guest this hour, Scott Jasek. He's one of the co-founders of InsideHigherEd.com, Brighton High School graduate. And if you want to join the show, the number is 1-844-295-TALK. That's 1-844-295-8255. Let's take that a step further then. You mentioned a lot of these cases originate in an atmosphere where there's been consumption of alcohol. We can say it that way. Traditionally, fraternities come into the mix. What's going on in that respect?
I think this issue is bringing a lot more scrutiny of fraternities. Now, it's important to say that the vast majority of people in fraternities don't assault anybody, and it's also important to say that there are sexual assaults that take place on college campuses that have nothing to do with fraternities. At the same time, many, many of these cases do take place at fraternities, and that is prompting new policies. We just reported this week about Wesleyan University in Connecticut. There is a push there by faculty and students, and the board is considering this, to require fraternities to all go co-ed. Now, traditionally, fraternities have obviously been all male, and some colleges have also had sorority systems. They're saying at Wesleyan that the all-male environment encourages a degrading of women and creates a culture in which women may be vulnerable. At Amherst College in Massachusetts, they eliminated fraternities and sororities as part of the campus some years ago, but they permitted sort of unofficial off-campus fraternities to thrive. And many women and activists on the campus believe that those off-campus fraternities have contributed to a certain culture. And so there, the college announced that they're going to ban anyone from being a member or living in one of those off-campus fraternities. So you do have this pushback at fraternities on some campuses. At many other campuses, there are huge Greek systems that are not being touched. But there is a view of many that without looking at fraternities, without looking at alcohol use, talking about sexual violence in isolation won't go far enough. Also important to remember, fraternities are, with their alumni and current students, tend to be tremendously popular. So it's very hard for a college to take them on.
Right, and a lot of donations and such obviously come from those who are affiliated and lifelong members of a brotherhood or a sisterhood. Very interesting. What do we know about the percentages of reported, because that's all we have, reported sexual assaults, sexual violence, and the correlation with alcohol? Is there, what kind of numbers are we?
Very high correlations with both. I mean, a disproportionate number of sexual assaults that are reported on college campuses involve either alcohol or fraternities or both, because obviously a lot of fraternity parties, big shock, have a lot of alcohol. So it is very hard to sort of decouple these issues. At the same time, it's also important to remember at many campuses, they may rely on fraternities and sororities for housing, to provide housing for students, to provide a social environment for students. So it's difficult for a college to say, oh, we're going to ban the Greeks. If you've been housing your students in Greek houses, and if you've been relying on the Greek system to provide social events. At Amherst, for instance, only about 10% of students have any relationship to the Greek system, and yet there's a sense that social life has revolved around the Greek system.
Interesting.
So these are tough issues to handle.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's interesting, and that's why we love to have you on the show, those extra insights, especially on an issue that's so emotional. People get angry, and rightfully so. That's my opinion. And to just, you know, pull the plug on something that has been historically a big part of a lot of schools and funding, and like you say, the social stuff as well. Did you hear about a fraternity that was doing away with hazing and putting in some true gentleman's agreement or some substitute?
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. Several fraternities have announced, national fraternities, have announced that they're going to ban hazing and instead create a pledging. The process of pledging will be more about learning about the fraternity and the house's history, surface projects, and so forth. This could be a very positive thing. At the same time, I have to be the cynical journalist here and say, I'll believe it when I see it. Mm. We've had fraternities that have pledged to go dry and not have alcohol and then get charged with various alcohol-related offenses. We've had places that have banned hazing. I mean, officially, all the fraternities banned
right,
hazing.
Right, right.
That's not a new thing. And so, officially, nobody hazes, and yet, year after year, you find these incidents, and sometimes students die. I mean, it's not people sort of imagine a little bit of campus hijinks, but the reality is students are dying in hazing incidents, and colleges are very worried about this at a altruistic level. They don't want their students to die, but their legal folks are very worried about colleges getting sued. Fraternities they vary from campus to campus. At some campuses, they are clearly part of the university and overseen by the university. Many other places, they're off campus with limited university oversight. And yet, parents sort of assume that somebody at the college is watching what's going on, which may or may not be true.
Right, right. Does the First Amendment come into any of this at all in terms of, I know the First Amendment deals with the government putting restrictions on speech, but when you have state universities and you get into state action, color of law, that type of thing, the right to organize. Hey, look, we just want to organize. We're calling it a fraternity. Has that ever been used in any of this?
It has been used. And generally, students at public universities would have more rights to decide they want to do an off-campus house or whatever than at private. Private colleges and universities obviously aren't covered by the First Amendment, and they tend to have much more latitude to regulate student conduct as long as they do it in a way that's consistent with their own policies. When private colleges get sued, if their actions they take seem inconsistent with what they've told students, it's much harder for a public college to do this, to ban a Greek life. The other thing is that at you know, replacing Greek life can be expensive. And so, again, if you are a cash-strapped public institution, and many publics are, you may not be able to afford to say, oh, we're going to build a new dorm system to replace this. We're going to, you know, whereas a particularly the privates I cited are fairly well-off privates. And so they, if they go down the road they go, they're talking about, they can afford to do certain things. At Wesleyan, for instance, where they're talking about making the fraternities go co-ed, several of their fraternities are parts of national organizations that say they will kick them out and revoke their charters if they admit women.
Interesting.
So that is an added pressure.
Wow, so much going on here. Again, our guest this hour, Scott Jasik. He is one of the co-founders of InsideHigherEd.com. If you want to join the show, the old numbers are still working, folks, 263-9994, 263-WXXI, but 844-295-TALK is going to be the number now and in the future. So why don't we go right to the phones? We have Jane in the city. Jane, welcome to Connections, Education Friday.
Yeah, I know this is a downer, but it's true that in some bars, you can get thrown out if the bartender or security thinks you've just had too much. Why couldn't there be a responsible adult at those parties to kind of have a look over of what's going on, what could be risky, and if you've had too much, you know, I guess they live there. If they live there, they can't be thrown out. But can't we have a responsible adult to tell a person, you've had enough? Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Well, actually, that relates to a hot idea in colleges to deal with alcohol abuse and sexual assault, which is called bystander intervention. And the idea is that college students naturally don't want to pay attention to an authority figure. So can you train fellow students to intervene when in a low-key way when they see a student who's clearly drinking too much, to intervene when they see a woman sort of who might be being dragged off somewhere or being pressured to do something she may not want to do, that may be more effective. If you send a bunch of police to every fraternity party, they will just leave and go somewhere else. But another important issue to remember is that most college students, even if they are not of legal drinking age, are in fact legal adults. So it is not always easy to police their actions.
Interesting. And again, that the idea of the peer pressure, trying to use that as a as a solution, some, you know, just subtle, hey, look, guys, this is uncool, that type of thing.
And that's huge, because historically it has been uncool to intervene. And by trying to change that, to look out for one another as students, could have a very significant impact on reducing the number of incidents. Obviously, you know, a lot of the discussion is how do you punish sexual assaults that take place. Far better is to prevent them from taking place.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones. We have Elizabeth. Elizabeth, welcome to Connections Education Friday.
Hi. I just had a question for your speaker on substance-free dorms. I just learned about this a couple of days ago, and I was wondering why they would even be necessary. It seems to me all of the dorms on campuses should be substance-free.
Well, that is a trend to have substance-free dorms, and the idea is that even if you believe that all dorms should be substance-free, they will not be substance-free. And it is very hard for a freshman whose roommate maybe has a lot of beer in there or whatever and doesn't or drugs and doesn't want that environment. By creating a substance-free zone or substance-free dorms, they are making it possible for students who don't want it to self-select and be in an environment where there won't be various substances. There are some colleges where, generally religious institutions, where booze and drugs are truly not tolerated at all. That is not the norm, and so the substance-free dorm is an alternative so that even if you're at a college where everyone's partying, you might have a space where you're not.
Right. But in acknowledging that this dorm is a substance-free dorm, isn't it implied that you're acknowledging that, well, the other ones are not substance-free?
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, and that need not be terrible for everyone in those other dorms. There, you know, one of the criticisms of sort of U.S. policy on alcohol abuse is that by making the drinking age 21, they've made it impossible for 18-year-olds to learn to drink responsibly. And there are a lot of college presidents who feel that they're put into a sort of very awkward position on the issue because they have to pretend that it's equally bad for a 19-year-old to have two beers as for somebody to drive drunk or drink to the point where they're truly in danger for their life. But that's just the reality is there is beer in most dorms, and the substance-free option just creates another choice.
Okay. And speaking of substances, InsideHigherEd.com followed up on the story here regarding the student who died of, I guess, a heroin overdose, or
yeah.
I don't know if that's been confirmed with the autopsy yet, but what can you tell us about that, Scott?
Well, when people think about substance abuse on campus, they think about alcohol, they think about attention deficit disorder drugs, various psychological drugs. They don't think about heroin. But as was true in this Rochester case, there are heroin overdoses happening on campus, not in the same numbers as alcohol abuse, but the chances of one use leading to a tragedy like a student death may be far greater with heroin. At the University of Rochester, the president reached out to everyone on campus and sent a message to everyone on campus saying, look, this is a serious problem. These are places to get help. And in doing so, actually, he took what the experts are saying needs to happen in higher ed, which is to talk about the issue and to say it's a problem. And a lot of colleges have been reluctant to speak out because it's a kind of drug use that people don't want to associate with higher ed.
Again, you know, we don't have that at our prestigious university. The word heroin does not – you don't think of heroin and hallowed halls of higher ed in the same sentence, but the reality is, yeah, it's all there. And some of that may have to do with the other societal side issue of prescription painkillers and folks who get hooked on those or, you know, start – that's their drug of choice. Sometimes it's easier to get heroin than to get that prescription refilled.
Well, heroin use has grown generally in the United States, so this is not a campus-unique situation. But per your point about other drugs, I'd say much of the unregulated drug use on campus is right now prescription drugs. As more and more college students are arriving on campus already with prescriptions for various psychological or attention deficit disorder conditions. Now, there is nothing wrong with people being treated for those conditions, but if you take those drugs and mix and match with alcohol and other drugs, or if you trade the drugs with your friends,
right,
which is a pattern, which is what's going on, then they're used unwisely. The other thing is most of those drugs are intended for use in conjunction with psychological care, not just as a recreational tool, you know, recreational thing. And so that there's much more of that than, say, the heroin. But the heroin, as Rochester saw, great potential for tragedy.
Yeah, and very, very sad. But there's good news in the world of higher education, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to take a short break here. Again, our guest this hour is Scott Jasek, Brighton High School graduate of Cornell University, co-founder of InsideHigherEd.com. We're covering hot topics in higher education for this hour of Connections Education Friday. You can call us at 844-295-TALK or 263-9994, 263-WXXI. I'm Frank Sigelski. We'll be back in a minute. This is WXXI AM and WXXI.org.
Coming up in our next hour here on Education Friday, Frank sits down with Rochester School District Chief Patty Malgeri, along with their CFO, highlighting the district's budget. And they're also going to talk about the future of East High. Then from 1:30 to 2, Alice Carley of the Eastman School of Music's Sibley Library teaches us about preserving musical scores. It's all coming up second hour on Education Friday.
All righty. Continuing on Connections Education Friday, I'm Frank Sigelski. Our guest this hour, Scott Jasek from InsideHigherEd.com. Scott, another local story, and it has to do with and I don't know if this is a trend nationally, or you, I'm sure you can tell us, the University of Rochester forming some sort of partnership with East High School. The budget was passed last night, which included affirmation of that being, you know, a potential. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, I don't know much about the University of Rochester East High deal, but generally, there has been a move by a number of prominent universities to cooperate with, in some cases actually to manage, local high schools. And the thinking is many urban high schools, while they may have outstanding educators there, lack for funds, lack for support to do the things they need to do. And then sometimes you have a local university, and the U of R would fit this, that both have education schools and experts on education, and that may have resources that a local high school doesn't have. There have been successes, and some of these cases haven't gone well. Some of the things that are really crucial to make these work are a long-term commitment. Turning around whatever the issues are in a high school does not happen overnight, so you need a university that is committed to it, not as a one-year thing, but as a long-term process.
Mm-hmm.
And you need everyone to understand what's going on. The U of R isn't going to turn a high school probably into, have the same facilities that you have at the U of R, but what can the meaningful role be, not just money, but expertise, involvement. There's also a sense that for places with schools of education that train teachers and school administrators, the closer connection they have to actual schools, the better, in that they can frame their curriculum based on the knowledge of what actually goes on.
Interesting. How big of a trend is this? Do you have any numbers?
I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but the U of R is not breaking new ground in doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So these are out there at a lot of places, and they, and people are looking right now, I'd say, for new ideas to help high schools, to help public school systems. For the universities, though, it also means a different kind of scrutiny. A private university like the U of R may not be used to, parents. They probably get plenty of helicopter parents with their own students, but that's very different from a parent of a local high school student who has an opinion on some policy. And so there are different sort of pressures, and there's different obligations. The U of R is a private institution. East High is part of a public school system. So there are all kinds of issues to work out. At the same time, it can be really positive when you have both expertise and resources to get involved.
What, in addition to the long-term commitment that the higher education institution and the high school need to make, and you alluded to that as being one marker of successful programs, what are the other types of arrangements that would suggest or lead to more success in a partnership, or whatever you want to call it, of this nature?
Well, there are partnerships of all kinds, and I don't want to judge that one is the best way to go. I'd say very clear expectations is probably the key, because this ranges all the way from, sending in a few professors to work with teachers to a much more involved role, at some places with them actually taking over management of a school or schools. And so, I'd say wherever they are on that spectrum, defining the roles, defining this is what the U of R is going to do, this is what East High is going to do, this is what the faculty are going to do, having that very clearly understood, I'd say, is important. Many people at an urban high school may look at a university like the U of R and think, wow, unlimited resources. That's probably not the case. And so having very clear expectations and goals, and a sense that, this is what we think we can accomplish in year one, this is what we're hoping to accomplish long term, those tend to guide these sorts of relationships in realistic ways.
Yeah, that's it. I just sitting here thinking about it. Yeah, you're right. Some folks might think, finally, we're saved. It's a panacea for all our problems, whether you're talking about the high school or the college or the university. And others may think, well, this is no big deal. It's just like, hiring a vendor to do lunch service. It's just another service. So spelling that out and maybe having clear markers of success or failure would be good to do. So anyway, 263-9994-263-WXXI, the new number, of course, we're going to be using more often and indefinitely is 844-295-TALK. Scott, where do you want to go next? I mean, there's so much going on. We had the Supreme Court talk about affirmative action, but then there's also those, I guess we could call them lighter stories. And one that we teased at the top of the hour was, I think it's Bradley University or College banning taking of selfies during graduation.
Sure.
What's going on with all that?
Sure. Well, if you go on any campus, you see tons of students with their smartphones. They're sort of omnipresent. And one of the things students like to do is to take selfies. And it obviously depends what kind of graduation you are running, but the fear at some universities is that if you are running a ceremony where every student is called by name and crosses the stage and shakes hands and, mm-hmm. and takes a diploma, well, and then they take a selfie.
Right.
You're talking about a serious expansion of time, and let's be honest, families may love that one moment when their kid is crossing the stage, but
do you
really want the length of time to double so that everyone can take a selfie? More broadly than just selfies is there is something of a culture gap on campus over appropriate use of technology, over appropriate use of smartphones. Professors complain constantly about students who are texting in class or surfing Facebook or actually having their phone go off in class. So the whole sort of concept of etiquette is one that I'd say is evolving on campus as students who are digital natives are amazed that anyone would tell them that there's a time that's inappropriate to be on the phone.
Well, what are some models out there that schools are using? I mean, because you're right, this is a sort of brave new world, and there are arguments on both sides. I mean, zero tolerance, power it down for the next 45 minutes because here's a live person instructing you, or look, you know, my kid might be sick or whatever, can I leave it on vibrate, blah blah blah. And then thinking back to that graduation issue, you got to throw in the photo bombers who would invariably will be there to disrupt
right.
whatever the heck's going on. But what are some models that schools are using, colleges, universities
well,
are using?
I mean, what the colleges that have banned selfies at graduation, what they're going to a model of just spelling out the rules. And there's a certain point to that in that if you haven't said this isn't acceptable conduct, you can't really be shocked if some students do it. And you see that all over the place. There are colleges that say if you have a laptop open during class, it can't be on social media. It must be, you know, for note-taking or materials related to class. That is tough to enforce.
Mm-hmm.
We've written about studies where people have hired people to go to the back of the room and counted the number of laptops open to Facebook as opposed to the course page, and the results would depress most faculty members.
Mm.
At the same time, it's important to remember that some of this isn't brand new. You know, once upon a time, students may have read the New York Times or done a crossword puzzle in a class in which they weren't fully engaged as well before they had laptops. So, but the laptop is particularly visible. The text is very visible. And some of this goes larger than just students. You know, I go to a lot of academic meetings with professors and whatever, and I'm amazed cell phones go off there too. So as a society, we probably need to think a little bit about how to be polite. But the policies range from trying to strictly enforce to completely ignoring it. We wrote about a professor at Syracuse University a few years ago who had a policy that if a phone went off or it caught somebody texting, he would just leave the class that day. The whole class was canceled.
Wow.
And people had mixed feelings about that. But many professors do feel very insulted by this, and many students feel like, what's the big deal? That's just the way they live their lives.
You know, I wonder if just sort of brainstorming here, but if the phone goes off in class, if I were the professor, I'd say, okay, your phone went off. Come on up here. You finish the lecture. I'm going to sit where you were sitting.
And you know, and you can try that. And then, of course, everyone, you said, well, what if somebody has a sick relative? Everyone's got an excuse. Now,
yeah.
I don't think they that at a undergraduate institution, most people really are all dealing with a sick relative or some truly urgent
right.
event. But, you know, professors don't want to be in the, you know, in the place of having to be judge and jury on those things, and they don't want to be interrupted, and they don't want to be disrespected. You know, and now some have done it by trying to make students use social media in a positive way, sort of requiring people to tweet, to post on Twitter during class about the class.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, so there's also a if you can't beat them, join them philosophy.
Oh, that sounds great. I'd have some of my students maybe working on a side business adventure or, you know, it's unlimited, Scott.
Yeah.
I got a mind that works that way. Fortunately, you have a mind that works the way you do, and I can't stump you. I can ask you anything I want to about inside higher ed or higher education, and you're going to have the answer. If you're listening out there and you've got something for Scott Jasik, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and also 263-9994, 263-WXXI. All right, what else do you got on your, on your plate? What's going? Just talk about what is trending.
Sure.
What's trending now?
You mentioned the affirmative action case.
Right.
The Supreme Court recently ruled that Michigan was within within its rights to bar public colleges and universities from considering race and ethnicity in admissions. Michigan and several other states, the largest being California, have such state bans, and by the Supreme Court affirming the right of states to do that. Now, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court affirmed the right of colleges to, in certain ways, consider race and ethnicity. So what they've now said is affirmative action can be legal, but it's not required. You can ban it, too.
Interesting.
And so what we're ending up with is a country where some states have affirmative action and some don't.
Right. Very interesting. Very interesting. What about the labor union issue? You know, I think it was Northwestern University
sure.
in Chicago. They formed a union.
This is a huge issue right now. Now they haven't yet formed a union. They petitioned to form a union, and they voted, but we don't know the results of the vote because Northwestern appealed the decision. Athletes have not, and now the current proposal before the NLRB would permit football players to unionize at private institutions. Public institutions are governed by state law and state labor boards. This goes much bigger than just whether Northwestern football players should have a union to really the question of, are college athletes and big-time college athletes, are they really just students? Or are they employees? Is their experience so different that they are really employees of the university and so deserve collective bargaining rights? Pretty much every college association is up in arms about this, says this would be a disaster. Not all the public agrees. Most polls have shown that a majority of the public backs the colleges and doesn't think athletes should unionize. But interestingly, among African Americans, there's more support for the union idea. And a complicating factor here is when people say unions and student athletes, what's the deal? They're really very different kinds of student athletes in higher education. A football player at a Division I institution is having a very different experience than maybe a soccer player at Brockport. And so it's hard to generalize across all of the student experience.
It's interesting. You may call them a student athlete, but what you call them doesn't necessarily reflect the actual relationship. And as you sit here and think about it, that's absolutely right. At what point do the, you know, call them semi-pro athletes at certain institutions? At what point are they on the staff of the school? Or you could take it all the way to its furthest extreme. Why not have professional sports teams named after universities?
Well, there's a school of thought that among some who are skeptical of the role of big-time athletics in higher education, that we'd be better off if we had minor league teams for all sports, not just like, you know, not just those that we do have, and took the colleges out of the role of basically being the minor leagues for football and basketball in particular, and that they're running mini businesses. If you look at those who are in big time basketball, football programs, their experience being admitted to college is different. They likely have a different living situation. They quite likely have a different academic situation. They have entire tutoring services that are not available for the rest of the students. Their chances of graduating differ. It's all over the place. But whereas historically there have been low graduation rates for big-time football and basketball players, men's players, in many other sports, and for women, athletes do well academically. So it's just, it's important not to generalize.
You should never generalize. Where do you see this trending? Again, you can't generalize, but is there any other markers we should be thinking about as we see this issue develop over the next few years?
Well, the colleges that have big-time athletics are very, very worried about this. And they are talking about ways to provide new benefits. They don't want to pay them, per se, but new benefits, expanded scholarships for athletes. They want to address some of the athletes' concerns to make them less likely to unionize. So on the one hand, they're sort of using the, you know, don't feel you need to unionize approach. But in court, they're going to fight this. I would be stunned if colleges, if they lose the next round before the NLRB, I would be almost certain they will file suit and take this all the way to the Supreme Court. So the current Northwestern football players, my guess, will be graduated long before this issue is resolved. I wouldn't expect a union anytime soon. I don't know, and it'll probably depend who's on the Supreme Court at the time. The other big issue that is changing things, I think, is particularly in football, is the concussion issue. In that what athletes care about, particularly in football, isn't just money and benefits, but also their health. And there has been a growing body of evidence recently that playing football and particularly having concussions has long-term health impact. And that's an issue that may make athletes more likely to want representation, particularly if they feel that their institutions aren't looking out for them.
Yeah, interesting. And the concessions have already been granted in terms of, well, the NCAA said that student-athletes can now have unlimited food. Is that?
Yes, and that's the kind of thing that I think we're going to see. Right now the NCAA is looking for things to do that would make athletes feel good. Remember, that also raises the costs of athletics. And colleges are under a lot of economic pressure right now. Many people assume, because they look at the big TV deals and the packed stadiums, that athletics makes money. Almost all but about 23, 25 colleges lose money on athletics. So to appeal to the athletes who might be tempted to join a union, if they increase spending, that's going to create other problems.
Yeah, and I think that's important, because I assumed that, wow, look at all this money. You're saying that 23, 25 schools make money on athletics, the rest don't. Is this just D1, obviously? We're not going to talk about it.
And that's the thing, that to have a big-time athletic program, while they bring in lots of money, they're spending a fortune on building those stadiums, the better facilities, big money on coaches, the Jumbotron, whatever it is, there's like a competition to have the best. So while they're bringing in a lot, they're spending more.
Yeah, right. Interesting. All right, Scott Jasik is our guest for this hour of Connections Education Friday. Okay, we could go into maybe distance learning, online learning, MOOCs. That's always a huge issue. Anything new there that we need to know about?
Sure. Well, I mean, online MOOCs, which are sort of free online courses, there's a lot of hype about that a year or two ago, and they're still here and they're doing a lot, but I would pay more attention to the growth of for-credit online learning, which more and more students are doing, including students enrolled at traditional institutions who want, who want the convenience or a particular set of issues. It changes the way professors teach, but many students like it. And sort of like the selfie issue, as students who are arriving on campus are used to getting some information that way, they're just going to consider that part of the normal college experience.
I notice it's just, looking, there seems to be a lot more advertising for, an example that comes to mind is it's Southern New Hampshire University.
Mm-hmm.
They've got like a national advertising program for their online distance learning. This is really weird.
Well, unless you think, that's how they're trying to make their brand and their reputation. And they're competing. Southern New Hampshire is a nonprofit. They are really trying to take on the for-profit universities with both online learning, and then they have this new program that is also sort of the cutting edge of what a lot of institutions are doing, which is competency-based education. There, in traditional degree programs, you're told you have to earn X number of credits by enrolling in X number of courses. Competency-based is more you have to demonstrate that you have certain skills and competencies, regardless of whether you've taken any courses at all. Southern New Hampshire is a big online program and also a growing competency-based program. And so they want, aside from their name being geographically based, they want students from everywhere.
That's fascinating. It turns the whole, I have a diploma, I got it in, 3 weeks. I kind of like the Abraham Lincoln option. I don't have a degree, but I've been doing a lot of reading.
And if that reading adds up, the idea of competency-based education is that it should count for something. There are, if you look at online competency-based, but also traditional forms of education, there are highly rigorous programs that really make sure you know something, and then there are those that are just trying to, diploma mills. Southern New Hampshire is well-respected, accredited, knows what it's doing, but whenever there's a new idea in higher ed, part of the problem is you do get less credible actors coming in as well.
Okay, so let's go to being accredited and the whole issue of quality assurance in these areas. What's going on there?
So a lot of scrutiny from the Obama administration and others. In theory, for a college to operate, it's licensed by its state, but it is also accredited, meaning someone's paying attention to what's going on there with periodic reviews and making sure that they have the right resources, the right faculty, the right program design. The idea of accreditation isn't to force a single curriculum or single style of education on colleges, but to make sure they have a coherent plan so students aren't being ripped off. There are lots of students who are all the time getting ripped off by enrolling at questionable institutions. In theory, accreditation is the quality control for that.
Okay, so I want to take a course, an online course, and what do I do to make sure?
You look at who's accredited. You look for it. There are websites where they'll say, well, for whatever reason we're not accredited. That would be a red flag. Then when you see the accreditor, you can go on the Education Department website or a group called the Council on Postsecondary Accreditation Council on Higher Education Accreditation, and see they run lists of reputable accreditors. And so you can make sure that the accreditor who's listed, in fact, does accredit the institution. Where this is particularly important is people looking for education in, say, a health professions field, where in addition to the general accreditation, there is frequently specialized accreditation, a group that evaluates nurses or physical therapists or whoever. And so it's important to know that, say, in New York State, to take the state licensure exam, you must attend a nursing program that is accredited by whomever, and then to make sure that all lines up. There have been some questionable online programs outside of your area that have enrolled students even though they couldn't sit for the exam when they got their degree. And so particularly in the health professions where there's a lot of state rules, it's important to be certain of this.
Yeah, especially when they're going to be treating people, presumably when they, quote, graduate.
Absolutely. You don't want the person who's attending your health not to be know their stuff.
Right, right. So we have to accredit the accreditors.
Yes, which sort of the federal government does. And the problem is just for many students, this is just a giant mystery, and they don't pay attention, and they pay a little too much attention to, say, an ad that says, you know, train with us and you'll be eligible for a job in which you earn X, Y, or Z. You really need to look at the details.
Yeah, fantastic. And no one better than you to get the details of higher education. I want Scott, fantastic hour as always. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll do it again soon. That is, of course, Scott Jasek, a graduate of Brighton High School, co-founder of InsideHigherEd.com, and we'd like to thank him very much for his appearance today. All right, I'm Frank Sigelski. You're listening to Connections Education Friday on WXXI AM and WXXI.org.